was thinking about this practice of contemplation, contemplating, for example, the danger in sensuality, or various types of contemplation. Can you describe how to do that? Like, do you recite some things that you've heard, or what do you do?
Right, so that's like the contemplation has to start by learning what you need to contemplate. So you can, you know, you can start on your own, but your experience, top to bottom, is already affected with avijja, already affected with ignorance, which means that contemplation will be biased, will have will contain contradictions that you're unaware of, and it would not be necessarily representing the nature of things, how they actually are. So in order for you to start undoing all of those issues through right contemplation, you need to really learn what you need to contemplate, what you need to see. So that's why learning is important. Learning for the sake of meaning. Like you learn something so to understand what you need to do and see. Not just learn so you have information to counter somebody else or for the comparison between different aspects of the suttas and so on. Sometimes people confuse learning with just, as I said, collecting a vast amount of references and information, and then when they hear one point, they connect it to another point they heard. But it's like, well, that's kind of irrelevant. What's relevant is that when you hear one point, have you developed it? Have you followed it through? Have you contemplated it until the meaning sunk in and now you know for yourself? Or does your contemplation stop with just comparison between the suttas and different things that the Buddha said that you kind of adopted now as the truth? So the practice of contemplation then, well, if you learn it from the suttas, one of the first and most obvious things will be that, well, you can't really contemplate accurately the nature of your experience, the nature of your action, the nature of wholesome, the nature of unwholesome, unless you begin to emulate that nature through sense restraint and keeping the virtue. In other words, if you're running around wild, like a wild animal, letting your mind go here and there, letting your physical behavior do what it wants, that contemplation will not have a fertile ground. You might be pondering about things theoretically, abstractly, but if you want the meaning of that contemplation to start affecting your experience, your behavior, you need to start tailoring that behavior beforehand. That's where the virtue comes first. So what I'm basically saying in simple terms is there is no contemplation unless you have developing virtue and sense restraint as its basis. So, but say you do, you are keeping the precepts, you are celibate, you are guarding of the sense doors, you're watchful of your intentions. Well, then you contemplate, just take a sutta, read a sutta, see what it talks about, and then try and understand those things for yourself. Not, well, initially it will be on the level of making sense out of it, but then also, like, you need to see it for yourself here and now, in this experience. So that's the point of every sutta. That's why, like, technically, if you understand one full sutta, you can be an arahant, any sutta. So contemplation then begins by recognizing the universals from that sutta. What is applicable here and now? And that's why most of the suttas, they always talk about that. The nature of craving, the nature of assumptions, the nature of wrong views. And that is pretty much what you need to see here and now. So you start contemplating by, in this case, you could just, for example, say, ask yourself, why am I suffering? So asking right questions is the beginning of successful contemplation. Keeping the precepts and guarding the sense doors is the beginning of successful contemplation. And then asking the right questions can sort of take you in the right direction. So why am I suffering? That can be a contemplation. So it can be any theme that you get from the sutta. I mean, the Buddha talks about monks, you know, the eyes are burning, the senses are burning. It's like, okay, so what did he really mean by that? Like, everybody can make sense out of it, but there is a level of making sense out of it intellectually, and then there's a layer of, if you actually understood it where it's supposed to be understood, you would be free from your senses. So you need to recognize that. And see, that's another contemplation you can do. The extent of the sutta application. Like, by making that clearer, well, you have a better chance of applying it correctly. So then, asking questions such as, why am I suffering? Why am I liable to suffering? Could I suffer if nothing is held dear to me? Is it possible to be equally liable to pain if I'm sense restrained, withdrawn from unwholesome things, or if I'm just careless acting out of desires and proliferating and scratching the itch further? So pretty much anything that pertains to the nature of experience, nature of desire, nature of craving, freedom from it, can be used for contemplation. But that is the point. Actively thinking about it so that the meaning of it actually sinks in. So next time you won't have to ask that question, because now you understand that attachment is the basis for suffering. You see that. So from then onwards, whenever you recognize an attachment in your experience, you don't need to go through the motions of, oh, well, this is suffering, this is the root of pain. Because if you do, it means you haven't understood it fully. So you haven't contemplated thoroughly enough. But if you did, recognizing attachment will already carry an implication, this must be undone, without any further questions asked. Because you already saw a direct connection between that and pain, and liability to pain. So, and really that's like the only method that you can say that can lead you to awakening. It's that diligent contemplation of your motivation, of the nature of experience, not in abstract terms, but in terms of your liabilities, your desires, your attachments, and so on. As I said before, I think, like long time ago when I was a layman, you know, you start learning Buddhism from all sorts of sources. You don't necessarily know what's right, what's wrong. And yeah, I was doing meditation techniques and loads, I don't know for how long as well. And then the example I always give was like, I remember, it happened on numerous occasions, obviously, but it's like, so I'm keeping the precepts, I'm sense restrained, and that's all like, and I'm meditating like, you know, an hour in the morning, hour in the evening, because that's the practice. Like, I pick that up as a duty of somebody who wants to practice. You gotta meditate, you gotta watch your belly or nostrils or whatever sensations. I was doing it all. And the example I always give was like, so I want to go out with friends. Again, nothing unwholesome, nothing against the precepts, just wholesome company, fun, getting together. But if I just go out with friends, obviously I have a desire for company, for people, I felt guilty. So it's not against the precepts, but I knew enough to see that it's rooted in desire. So I felt guilty. So what do I do now? See, how do I deal with this? Well, let me do my practice duty of meditation so that then I can go out. So then I would sit and meditate and go out. And then I would come back and meditate. And then I'm fine. See, I have offset acting out of desire through meditation. And that was my life for a while. Fortunately, not too long, because things were becoming more and more apparent in a sense that, well, actually, see, the only reason I was doing this sense of duty is because I could not stop acting out of desire. So I realized that it would have been better off, and it will be better off, if I don't sit and meditate out of that duty at all, but instead don't act out of desire in the first place. See, if I didn't go out, I wouldn't have to be calming myself down with the meditation. People say, well, you know, meditation is good, it calms you down. Well, the question is, why are you disturbed in the first place? You can't be disturbed by circumstances. You can't be disturbed by the stone rolling and so on. You can only be disturbed by letting Mara in who disturbs you through greed, aversion, delusion. So if somebody needs meditation techniques to keep themselves calm, means they're perpetually disturbing themselves through their own acts and their own ignorance of their own intentions. And see, if you were to contemplate that long enough, it would sink in. And you will recognize, oh, important as important and unimportant as unimportant. So it's important to not disturb myself. And it's unimportant to manage it this way or that way. That's all secondary. Whether I meditated for an hour, did belly bhavana or watched my nostrils, all of that is now secondary to the fact that I acted out of the desire first. So if I'm not disturbing myself, if I'm not giving in to the desires, if I'm able to contain the impulse that making me act out of unwholesome, even if it's not necessarily against the precepts, then if there is any disturbance, sure, I'll calm myself within that. But then you'll realize pretty quickly, well, I am already composed simply by not spilling out through all these acts. And so, in other words, instead of sitting and mechanically trying to compensate for your lack of restraint, for your lack of understanding, compensate for that by actually sitting down for an hour in the morning, an hour in the evening, and contemplate nature of your experience. Why do you suffer? How did this disturbance come to be? All of the aspects that are relevant to that. And do that every day, twice a day. Because that at least can sort of, will be actually feeding your perspective and increasing your understanding. So then next time when something unpleasant happens or something challenging happens, again, you won't need to be resorting to a special set of circumstances where you will stop thinking and just calm down while this problem will remain waiting for you. You will already see through it and see the nature of it. And then you'll be like, oh yeah, of course, how could it be different? Attachment leads to suffering, and that is pretty clear. And that's why in the suttas as well, like monks, they've been contemplating things rightly, committed to it day in, day out. You know, he comes back from Pindapat, he purifies his mind from covetousness, from greed, from aversion. So where is lust in this? Is there lust in this experience? Can lust arise in this experience? Can ill will arise in this? What is the basis for ill will? Oh, well, you know, conceit, anger, not wanting to deal with discomfort. Okay, so, and then you basically take these reflections in all these myriad of directions you can do if you start asking right questions. And then those monks who are diligent like that would go and then they would encounter something shocking or something unpleasant, and it was like they would see through it. In other words, they would have done the work beforehand, and the last drop of the truth would have been when circumstances show them what they already understood, and then it would just sink in as like, oh yeah, of course, life is dukkha, the way out is like what I've been doing, and the mind gets liberated there and then. So people, like, obviously they don't see the background of this whole thing, which is like this intense development, sense restraint, guarding of the sense door, contemplation, day in, day out, purifying your mind from the unwholesome states. You read the sutta and you only see, oh, he met robbers, they tried to kill him, he became an arahant. Oh, he was so lucky. I was like, no. Those circumstances just emphasized what he already been contemplating and been understanding. So that's really, like, boils down to that. Like, if you actually tame your behavior, contain it, and then contemplate, and you will have plenty of material for contemplation. Every single desire, every attachment, everything you don't want to give up, loads of stuff. Pick it up, think about its cessation, see why you can't give it up. Then give it up, maybe. Like, scare yourself even through contemplation. Oh, but see, I don't even want to think about giving this up. Whoa, hold on. Why is that? Why am I refusing to go in that direction? Well, there is no development there if I willingly are choosing to turn a blind eye to something that's going to be quite possibly a deep attachment. So, oh yeah, just give away your attachment. No, you need to understand it. You can't just throw it away, because then you'll just, something else will take its place. No, you understand that whenever there is a phenomenon of attachment, an attitude of attachment in your experience, that equals suffering. So if I purify my experience from finding any safety in any dearness, any delight in external things of sense objects and so on, there is no basis for suffering anymore. And the more you do it, the clearer it becomes, and the confidence will be born from it. And then you won't need any more suttas to inspire you or the utterance of another how to contemplate a way to go. Pretty much anything you encounter, you'll be seeing the principles in it, questioning if they're unclear, for that right reason, for that right purpose.
Because if you take, you know, you can sort of start by taking for granted, okay, my idea of attachment, my idea of suffering, and now I need to kind of find out and figure out the connection between the two. But the correct contemplation, as I understand it anyway, would be more on the level of, like, wait, if I were to even kind of fully understand the first word in this sentence, attachment, then I'd be free from attachment and free from suffering.
Well, that's exactly, see, you would probably, everybody would start by these kind of not so accurate contemplations. But yeah, if you keep going in that direction, you would like, hold on, but do I even know what attachment is? Just saying attachment, what is it? Can I convey it to somebody else? Can I describe it? Or would I need to use some anecdotal examples? Can I describe the principle behind it, the universal nature of attachment? What is it? Can you have attachment without desire? Can you have attachment without craving? Like, can you have attachment without overlooking the basic nature of your own experience, of your own body, of your own senses? I was like, oh no. So you will, like, the more you do it, and that's what I mean, like, you need to start doing it. These contemplations will not, like, magically just take you all the way to asking the right questions and becoming an arahant through clarity and so on. It's going to be inaccurate in the beginning, but the more you do it, well, the more precise your own questioning will become, to the point where you don't even have to ask the question, just the way you look at things in your experience, it's already, questions are already implicit, the right direction is already implicit. So that's like through self-questioning on the basis of guarding of the sense doors and precepts and watching your intentions, you are narrowing down to where the actual problem is. So yeah, like the contemplation is something, the attitude of contemplation is something that could certainly take you from the state of a completely uninstructed putujana to a sotapanna who now knows where the problem is and knows how to uproot it.